Welcome to Stepping Out of Babylon, produced by Sue Supriano. Babylon is everywhere. It's the isms and schisms not only within the system, but within ourselves. Let's unify, stand aligned, and step out of Babylon.
Hi, everybody. My name's Sue Supriano, and my guest today is Tim Krupnik. I first had acquaintance with Tim when I saw his slideshow on permaculture in Africa here in Berkeley, California, at the Ecology Center. And Tim also works at the Ecology Center, where he is dealing with a recycling of plastics and educating people about plastics. As I say, that slideshow came out of 7 months in something like 10 countries in Africa. And you've just returned from Haiti, so I know we have a lot of things to talk about that are really important. So, Tim, I just would like you to give me a little background on this trip to Africa.
When I was a college student some time ago, I wrote my final project on desertification in Africa and sort of a political ecology of development in French West Africa and how French sort of industrial agricultural plantations led to famine and eventually civil wars, trying to link a lot of things together. So for a long time, I was very, very interested in going to Africa and spending time there and working with some kind of a volunteer project. And in between university and actually going, I became interested in permaculture and sustainable agriculture as a sort of on-the-ground solution to a lot of the problems that I saw coming out of this more industrial agriculture sort of model.
I'm just going to interrupt you for 1 second because I probably just said permaculture because I'm used to using it as an ordinary word in my vocabulary, but really 9 out of 10 people I talk to never heard of it, so we probably should say what it is.
Yeah. A little bit of a definition. I find that sometimes it's most simple to define permaculture and sustainable agriculture in light of what it isn't. And it isn't industrial agriculture, which is sort of the typical Western agricultural model of growing one crop or a monocrop, intensive tillage of the soil, use of hybrid seeds, chemical fertilizers, and pesticides to ensure growth, which sort of translates to a lack of biodiversity, soil erosion, erosion of social sustainability in the area, really just a sort of industrial mindset of growth and simplification.
Which wears out the soil and isn't good for the people who are doing the work for many reasons.
Right. There's all sorts of problems that have been associated with it. It definitely produces a high yield if you look at only one crop, but it is not efficient in terms of increased biodiversity or increased harvests of a variety of fruits. And it's really meant the extinction of a large variety of different fruit and vegetable species over time. And the poisons that are used as fertilizers and chemicals have definitely impacted populations and wildlife throughout the globe, both in the first world and in the third world. The problem is that I think in a lot of developing nations, or such as the nations in Africa that I was in, a lot of people aren't aware of the larger implications of these issues. A lot of pesticides aren't labeled in a native language, so people don't wear protection, for example. So that's some of the problems associated with that industrial agricultural mindset, or sort of what was known as the Green Revolution. Permaculture and sustainable agriculture are sort of responses to that. In many ways, well, permaculture is essentially a design system. It's a way of thinking about designing agricultural and farming systems that would mimic nature, or sort of farming in nature's image. It's very dependent on modeling gardens after forests, making use of trees and perennial crops that don't require constant tillage of the soil and thus cut down on soil erosion. They require less effort. They also create habitat for birds and other kinds of species, which in turn can be used to keep pest populations in check. So in a way, it's sort of a toolbox in a way of thinking about designing a sustainable agricultural system. But it goes further than simply something associated with agronomy. It bends into looking at energy and resource issues, so and water issues, and how you harvest. Do you harvest rainwater from a well? Do you take it from a dam? Or as permaculturists would try to do, would be harvesting rainwater from a roof and storing it for use in the garden later. So it's really about designing sustainable human settlements through an agricultural directive. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you saw a lot of different kinds of situations in Africa, I saw from your slideshow, in different places.
Right. Well, when I eventually went to Africa, I first landed myself in Ethiopia, where I worked on a project called the Integrated Biofarm Initiative. It's near the capital of Addis Ababa in Ethiopia. And what it was essentially this, you know, sort of 40-acre demonstration farm that was more or less a permaculture setup, and it was intended to be an educational site where farmers who were not farming in a sustainable way could come to get some kind of directive or learn from the situations that they were showing there. And so while a lot of like farmers in Ethiopia aren't necessarily even adopting the full range of Green Revolution packages, the hybrid seeds, the fertilizers, the pesticides, there's still serious problems with soil erosion and, you know, increased amounts of people encroaching on land. And a lot of those have to do with larger social issues and the loss of people's land due to what I was mentioning, due to people losing their lands to large agribusiness farms and all sorts of other situations. So when addressing sustainable agriculture, we always have to address land issues. We always have to address social justice issues and land access. But then there's also the technical aspect of what do you do and how do you do it. And so this project in Ethiopia was integrating many things. We had a dairy farm there, and we were producing methane biogas with the manure waste from the cows to use for cooking in the kitchen there, as opposed to cutting down more and more of the forest for firewood. We were encouraging bees and honeybee harvesting as a means of income generation for people, and also to ensure that there's pollinators out there so crops can be sustained. We were doing soil erosion and conservation measures and a number of agroforestry projects as well. So that's initially where I landed myself. And I expected to be there my whole time in Africa, but I took a break at one point and wound up hitchhiking to Nairobi. And that took me about a month. And once I got there, I was just so amazed and sort of excited to be in Africa, which is where I always wanted to go and see these things, that I decided to keep traveling rather than to return back to the project directly. So what I did over the next several months after that was go through, basically work my way down from Nairobi to South Africa, zigzagging across the map, and basically visiting non-governmental organizations and sustainable agricultural organizations and traditional farms that hadn't been affected by the sort of industrial agriculture mindset, and just taking photographs, interviewing people, and learning as much as I could about the process. So that was sort of my excuse to just have a jaunt through Africa, but also have it be something worthwhile and useful at the same time. So I visited a number of projects that used permacultural principles in the sort of development work that they were doing.
Well, it's always very inspiring to see something positive, especially in these times. And I remember a lot of people came to your slideshow that time. It was totally packed. So I think that there are so many people looking for positive alternatives, those of us who have any understanding about the negative aspects that you were talking about earlier, Tim. So what particular things stand out for you that you'd like to share? I mean, the one in Ethiopia sounds great.
Ethiopia was a very good project. The biofarm, unfortunately, I didn't see it actually reaching out to the people as much as I would have liked. It was sort of training non-governmental organization workers and government officials and saying, this is what a sustainable agriculture looks like, which is important, but it wasn't my taste of what I wanted to see. Some of the other really great projects that I saw, by far the cream of the crop was a project outside of Harare in Zimbabwe called the Fambutsane Permaculture Center, and Fambutsane means staple food in the language there. And the Fambutsane Center was about an 80-acre training center where they would actually bring rural farmers in to the center to receive sort of two-week crash courses in permaculture or organic farming or beekeeping and all sorts of these aspects. And then they'd go back out and work with a Fambutsane extension agent who would monitor their progress and make sure that there was, you know, that if they had problems that they'd find ways to seek solutions. But it was very impressive because basically they had this very dynamic and participatory way of going out to communities, identifying people who could use, you know, help or wanted to have some kind of training, and bringing them back to receive that. And I was most impressed with it because a lot of people miss this in Africa, but women farmers produce something like 70 to 80% of the agricultural crops and are always the ones working at the market. And I saw a lot of even quote-unquote sustainable agricultural projects that trained the men and addressed only the men and then claimed to be participatory. And what happened afterwards is the men would go back and tell the women what to do, but not with an understanding of how it would work. And Fambutsane, on the other hand, really reached out to women and really worked with them and gave them a sense of pride in what they were doing and knowledge. And that was a very important thing for me to see, and I was very, very much impressed by it. And so, actually, the slideshow that you spoke about, I'm really happy to say we raised a heap of money there that actually went back to Fambutsane, and in about 2 weeks' time from when this is recorded, they're actually going to do a permaculture class specifically for women from a very dry and arid area in Zimbabwe. So it's my hopes that, you know, that these sorts of trainings, you know, coupled with land reform, which does have to happen in Zimbabwe, unfortunately, it shouldn't follow the sort of mode that it's following now, that people can sort of better their livelihoods there. And that was a very, very, very impressive project that I saw.
Well, I know that water is becoming such a huge problem. I just heard today that people are really, there's a huge drought in Guatemala, and people are really suffering. And, of course, I know there has been in Zimbabwe and lots of places, and it's a growing problem in the world. Do you have anything in particular to share about that that's going to cheer me up at all? Tim Krupnik.
Water is a critical issue in the global south, be it to agriculture or people's livelihoods in general. I did see a lot of depressing things related to water. I saw a very depressing development project of the Lesotho Highlands Development Authority, which is funded largely by the World Bank, where they're building a series of five dams in Lesotho to supply water to major industry in South Africa. And the consequence has been the displacement of tens of thousands of people from their livelihoods and forced urbanization. And I also saw a lot of industrial farms that followed the Western mindset of putting in spray irrigation and these sort of systems where you're just flinging water out and up to a third of it evaporates before it even reaches the ground, whereas at the same time the women who live across the street in villages have to march for up to 6 miles a day there and back to fetch a few gallons of water for use at the home. So those sorts of things are definitely very problematic. There are a few projects working here and there that are encouraging people to harvest rainwater from their roofs if possible. Fambutsane in Zimbabwe, I was actually really pleased to see, they are managing to harvest rainwater from thatched roofs because a lot of people don't even have tin roofs in a lot of the rural areas in Africa. And a lot of sort of permacultural techniques revolve around sort of a landscaping mindset that encourages water infiltration into the landscape rather than runoff. So you dig sort of swelled ditches that capture water and infiltrate it into the land. Sort of the wise use of water, use of topical mulches in gardens, which is laying straw bale or some other organic material down that soak up water and then let it out finally as a sponge rather than just keeping the garden barren and allowing evaporation to happen. So a lot of those techniques play into those issues. Even at the biofarm in Ethiopia, for example, a lot of people can't afford to pave a driveway, but the driveway of the farm was designed in such a way that it caught all the runoff rainwater that came down once a day and directed it via a gutter into furrow irrigation in the fields. So a lot of it's permaculture won't necessarily say this is how you solve your water problems. However, it will give you a series of ideas and a toolkit, essentially, to think about designing your agricultural system in a way, or your living system in a way, that makes the most use out of your resources, be it water or energy or anything else along those lines.
Well, and it's so important for people to know this. I know so many people say to me, a surprising number really, about, well, we know about the problems, but we never hear about what to do. And, of course, I say, well, you know, universities, books, institutes, they're full of answers. It's not that we don't have them, but so often people don't really hear about them. So it's important to people for people to know about this. And there must be books, and I know there's several permaculture institutes just here in California.
Yeah, there's a number of resources. In the United Kingdom, there's a permaculture group. Just if you're a web user, there's hosts of resources out there to look at. In California, there's a number of them. And there's lots of courses being offered here and there. But the other thing I should add also that in terms of hope, permaculture is definitely, for a long time I was an environmental activist and I was always focusing on the negative things. And when I first got into studying permaculture and sustainable agriculture, it was like, wow, suddenly there's a vision of what we can do rather than simply what we need to fight against. And that was a very positive thing for me. And I think it's the same for a lot of people. But what you learn the more that you look at sort of permaculture or agroforestry or this agroecology and the study of sustainable agriculture, really a lot of what these people involved in these movements are doing are looking back to more sort of traditional forms of agriculture, to pre-industrial agriculture, to localized agriculture where people have been raising crops from the same sort of land for, you know, hundreds of years. And it's not always what we would necessarily term as ecologically or even socially sustainable. However, there's a number of clues and techniques that we can borrow from those sorts of things. For example, in permaculture, a very big thing that people point to is the Chinampa system of aquaculture in Mexico, where around Mexico City, a lot of these sort of mini farms are being lost now. But people would actually go out into swampy areas and drudge the soils at the bottom of the swamps and bring those soils up because they were high in nutrients and mound them and create gardens right next to the swamps themselves. And in that they would plant, and there was no need to apply chemicals or pesticides because the soils were so rich. And there was also trees growing nearby, and we were essentially growing in a natural setting instead of wiping the land clean and putting in something entirely artificial. And they were also growing fish and all sorts of other crops, if you will, in those places. So that was the Chinampa system in Mexico, and there are all similar systems in Africa as well. And not all of these are necessarily going to work everywhere. It's not a template to be followed, but that's sort of the beauty of finding hope in these permaculture or agroecology, sustainable agricultural systems, that if we look back and learn from the wisdom of the people who have been doing it for ages, and then combining it with other ideas from across the globe, then hopefully we can truly move forward to an agriculture that's not going to degrade the land or hurt people's livelihoods.
Really? Yeah. Well, I'd like to switch subjects a little bit, and maybe we should have done this the other way around because it's always nice to end with positive things. But I'm interested to know what it is that you do about recycling plastic. I know here in Berkeley, and you work at the Berkeley Ecology Center, there's only, for a long time, the Ecology Center said, we're not even going to pretend that we're, you know, to pick up plastic, because it's not true that it's recyclable, so we're not going to do this charade. And then they started, now they pick up one and two. Right. So what do you want us to know about recycling plastic, Tim Krupnik?
I want you to know that it's not really recyclable, actually. It's interesting you brought that up, because that was the drive for my why my position was created there. And I actually, the caveat to this I should say is also that I look at my work in recycling and waste management as an extension of my work in permaculture, because it's, as I said, permaculture is not solely about agriculture. It's about wise use of resources, and that's what recycling is. And unfortunately, I think that in many ways, the sort of, again, I'll bring up the industrial model. The industrial model of recycling is not necessarily socially or environmentally sustainable. And specifically, the problem with plastic materials are that not only are they incredibly toxic, that's a given, both to produce and consume and use and also to dispose of, but the recycling process is sort of, it's not necessarily a truth. The plastic industry for a long, basically started stamping the little chasing arrows, triangles, the recycling symbol on the bottom of their bottles. And we in the environmental community sort of said, you can't do that. You're making people think you can recycle these bottles when, in fact, you actually sort of can't. And I'll get to that in a second.
And plastic is all made from oil, is it?
Yeah. Plastics are actually made from ethylene, which is a natural gas that's derived from the crude oil refining process. Ethylene could also, incidentally, be used to produce electricity or for heating homes. But I should also say that I'm not necessarily advocating that people use fossil fuels for those ends, but that's where it comes from. But the problem with plastics is that when attempting to recycle plastics, because of the amount of toxic additives and the incredible mix of chemicals used to produce those containers, when you attempt to recycle it and melt it down, the molecular structure of the bottle or whatever it may be weakens. And so it becomes next to impossible to make a soda bottle back into a soda bottle. Instead, it does what we call downcycling, and it becomes plastic lumber or some other, or a fleece material, some other lower end use. And that material can't be recycled again. So really what it's doing is taking a long detour to the landfill. And if you look at the energetics of plastic production versus glass, for example, they're extremely high. It takes a lot of energy to pull oil out of the ground to create plastic, and it takes a lot of energy to recycle it. Glass, on the other hand, is next to nothing if we were actually to look at the figures. So what we do, or what I'm doing there, is to try to educate people about these issues and to work on decreasing consumption. And then also, and it goes back to the permacultural design thing, is bringing up the idea of zero waste, which is a movement happening in recycling now where we want to end the use of these kinds of products and actually work with companies to redesign the way that they're manufacturing products, to stop before we even begin this process, and to move from the idea of that we have to have waste management to saying, hey, if we design what we're doing with these products in a sensible way, then we can actually design waste out of the whole equation. So it would mean working with biodegradable materials, working to make products that are easy to break down and reuse or to recycle. And so it's sort of this emerging movement that's happening now.
Well, that certainly is what makes sense. I mean, it's ridiculous to keep doing this. It's just, it makes me so sad and so upset seeing all this packaging and all this extra paper. It's just very upsetting. But so many people just don't pay any attention at all. So what about this circling sign? I mean, in these plastic container makers that did that, they're just basically lying.
Well, there was a series of court cases ages ago where they basically said, well, this isn't intended to make people think that it's recycling. This is intended to be just a coating system for different kinds of plastic resins. And that's how they got off, basically. Anybody out there with half a brain knows that that people think that it means recyclable. And it also depends on your definition of what recycling actually is and getting the best use out of your resources. So it's a problem, and it's going back to Africa, it's definitely a problem in sort of third world nations that have no waste management structure, that are being, at this point just sort of being forced into the global economy and are being inundated with inexpensive imports of a lot of American and European goods that are in wasteful packaging. What happens to that garbage at the end of their life cycle if you're in a place like Rwanda? It's either burnt, which emits a large amount of toxins, or it's simply thrown on the ground, which creates all sorts of other environmental health problems. So it's something that definitely needs to be looked at. And I think coupling it with this sort of permacultural and design emphasis of actually before implementing the project or before implementing the product or before, you know, allowing those things to happen, we think about how we want to design a sustainable society and what that means, then hopefully we'll start to move in the right direction.
Yeah, totally. So what about this one and two plastic, with it says one and two on the bottom of something being more recyclable than, there's a lot of them that say five, I've taken to always looking now.
Number ones and twos are the only bottles that are readily, I call it, reprocessed in the United States rather than actually recycled. The other numbers, you can find places that will reprocess them, but it's extremely rare. And I would say that's unfortunate, but I don't necessarily even think people should be recycling plastic instead of trying to use other materials, and then we need to go after companies that are producing it and try to move towards a more sensible option.
The irony is that a lot of the most healthy food comes in plastic containers, the organic, healthy stuff.
Yeah, and it is terribly ironic, and it's actually an area we need to begin to work on, but there's all sorts of problems with toxicity of the plastics, and it's a lot to get into, but if you want to read a great book, Our Stolen Future by Theo Kolbern addresses the migration of plastic polymers into all sorts of food products that are then ingested into the body. And I mean, there's studies out there that say, you know, women across the world have found concentrations of polystyrene in their breast fat. And so it's a very serious problem that's out there, but it's not focused on enough. And it's definitely been shrugged off even by the organic agricultural community. So hopefully we can wise up to that and start to look at those things in the future.
Really? No, that's where those hormone-interfering PCBs come from too, which are a heavy-duty issue in the world today, in this country. Well, Tim Krupnik, we've covered some very important things, and we're out of time. So you want to give some contact information?
Sure. I hate to only go via the computer, but if you're a computer person, you can email me at my email address, which is soilfirst, soilfirst, at tao.ca. Or if you're in the U.S. and you want to give me a ring on the telephone, my phone number is 510-653-7401. And I actually really love to hear commentary from people about these issues, and I love to meet people that are interested in them as well. So don't hesitate to get in contact.
And there are positive things happening, so it's just great to bring them together. Well, thank you very much, Tim Krupnik. And my name's Sue Supriano. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.